It's 70 years since the most significant trial of the 20th century began, as Germany's Nazi leaders were indicted for waging aggressive war, crimes against humanity, and inciting racial hatred, issues still of profound concern today. This drama, first broadcast in 1996, combines extracts from the trial with eyewitness accounts from victims, relatives, lawyers, and prosecutors. Nuremberg Trials.
Germany, May the 7th. 1945.
In the small hours of this morning, I saw the formal acknowledgement by Germany's present leaders, military leaders of their country's complete and utter defeat by land, in the air, and at sea. One moment there was in which pity might have come near, but the miss was as good as a mile. It was when, after he had signed away a freedom already lost, General Gödel rose to his feet. The German said these words, speaking his own language. With this signature, the German people and the German Wehrmacht are, for better or for worse, delivered into the victor's hands. In this hour, I can only express the hope that the victor will treat them with generosity.
Before anybody got to Nuremberg, there had been an immense amount of discussion, because there existed at that time, and still exists, no standing, permanent International Court of Criminal Jurisdiction.
Peter Carvel Caressi.
Therefore, this court was an ad hoc attempt to do something in the absence of the standing arrangements which one has under domestic jurisdiction. It was the best that could be done. It had flaws in it. But the alternative to doing it this way was to do nothing.
The cell block in the Nuremberg prison in which the defendants were kept, there were cells on both sides of a long corridor.
Drop your pants. Bend over. Spread your cheeks.
Yeah, okay.
No talking. This room stinks. You are a disgrace, Reverend Trout. Stop that man marching in the latrine.
Yes, sir.
I want this place kept spotless and clean.
Yes, sir.
The Americans had also brought along a psychiatrist, Dr. Douglas Kelly, and a clinical psychologist, Gustav Gilbert, who, having been born in Vienna, had the advantage of speaking German.
Though he was a Jew, he won their confidence. This man gives us a picture of the Nazi leadership that is unequaled in anything that I've read.
One of my first acts was to ask each defendant to autograph my copy of the indictment with a brief statement giving his opinion of it. Goering, the first, wrote his favorite cynical formula, "The victor will always be the judge and the vanquished the accused." Wilhelm Frick, Minister of the Interior, gave his legalistic reaction. "The whole indictment rests on the assumption of a fictitious conspiracy." Hjalmar Schacht, Reichsbank President and Minister of Economics before the war, declared, "I do not understand at all why I have been accused." Julius Streicher, Nazi Germany's number one Jew baiter, expressed his obsession even with respect to the trial. "This trial is a triumph of world Jewry." Field Marshal Keitel, Chief of Staff of the High Command of the Wehrmacht, gave the Prussian officers expected reaction. "For a soldier, orders are orders." Admiral Dönitz tried to laugh the whole thing off. "None of these indictment counts concerns me in the least. Typical American humor." The eccentric, emotionally unstable labor leader Robert Ley had given a prompt and decisive reaction to his indictment as a war criminal.
"I was sitting in my room early one morning, and in came a lieutenant wearing a black band around his head, and saying, ta da da da. And then he told me I had just lost my defendant. Why? He'd committed suicide the night before."
The trial began on November the 20th, 1945. With a comfortable break for Christmas, the prosecution case was to last 3.5 months.
They are waiting for the moment when a small door slides in back of the dock.
Joseph E. Persico, author of Infamy on Trial.
And the court and the audience get their first view of once powerful men who made the world tremble come marching down the stairway.
"The purpose for which the tribunal has been established is stated in Article 1 of the Charter to be the just and prompt trial and punishment of the major war criminals of the European Axis."
"May it please the tribunal, the United States of America, the French Republic, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics by the undersigned Robert H. Jackson, Francois de Menthon, Hartley Shawcross, and R.A. Rudenko, pursuant to the Agreement of London dated 8th August 1945, hereby accused as guilty of crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, and of a common plan or conspiracy to commit those crimes, Hermann Wilhelm Göring, Rudolf Hess, Joachim von Ribbentrop, Robert Ley, Wilhelm Keitel, Ernst Kaltenbrunner, Alfred Rosenberg, Hans Frank, Wilhelm Fritz, Julius Streicher, Walter Funk, Halmar Schacht, Karl Dönitz, Erich Rader, Baldur von Schirach, Fritz Zappel, Alfred Jodl, Martin Bormann, Franz von Papen, Arthur Seisenkrat, Albert Speer, Konstantin von Neurath, and Hans Fritsch.
I will now call upon the defendants to plead guilty or not guilty to the charges against them. Hermann Wilhelm Göring.
Bevor ich die Frage des Gerichtshofes beantworte, ob ich mich schuldig oder nicht schuldig bekenne.
Defendants are not to make a speech. Are you guilty or not guilty?
I declare myself, in the sense of the indictment, not guilty.
Rudolf Hess?
No.
That will be entered as a plea of not guilty.
There were two judges from each of the four powers. The main judges were Francis Biddle for the United States, Henri Donadieu de Fabre for France, Jan Timofeevich Nikitchenko for the USSR, and Sir Geoffrey Lawrence for the United Kingdom, who was also president of the tribunal.
Joachim von Ribbentrop?
Not guilty.
When the trial started, there were 22 defendants, one of whom, Martin Bormann, was tried in absentia.
It was an immense operation. The American team alone consisted of 2,000 people, who 200 were lawyers. Now, that is all the difference in, say, the British case, where, as far as I remember, there were six lawyers.
Hans Frank?
Not guilty.
Alfred Jodl?
Not guilty. For what I have done or had to do, I have a pure conscience before God, before history, and before my people.
In a destroyed Nuremberg, one of the survivors is this huge, frowning courthouse in room 600 with the memorable speech of Justice Robert Jackson. The trial opens.
May it please your honors, the privilege of opening the first trial in history of crimes against the peace of the world imposes a grave responsibility. That four great nations, flushed with victory and stung with injury, stay the hand of vengeance and voluntarily submit their captive enemies to the judgment of the law, is one of the most significant tributes that power has ever paid to reason. Now, this inquest represents the practical efforts of four of the most mighty of nations, with the support of 17 more, to utilize international law to meet the greatest menace of our times, aggressive war. We want to reach these, the planners, the designers, the inciters, and the leaders without whose evil architecture the world would not have been for so long racked with the agonies and convulsions of this terrible war. Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of the German Republic in 1933, and in perfecting control of the state, he and these defendants openly embraced the most hideous crimes against humanity. They openly battled against those dissident elements that they considered to be standing between them and their new order. They succeeded in dominating the trade unions, and next, they succeeded in dominating the churches. And this led to a relentless and cruel persecution of all pacifists and dissenting sects, such as the Jehovah's Witnesses. As to the Roman Catholic Church, property was confiscated and vandalized. Riots were stimulated and simulated, and many of the priests and bishops were interned. I shall now come to the crimes against the Jews, the third of my dissident groups. Determination to destroy the Jews at all times cemented this Nazi conspiracy, sometimes countering other differences amongst the party leaders, but there is not one of these defendants who have not echoed the rallying cry of Nazism. Deutschland erwache, Jude verrecke. Germany awake, Jury perish. And as to the waging of aggressive war, we intend to show you how the plans were laid long in advance. And moving on to crimes committed in the conduct of war. Germany was a signatory to the Geneva Convention, but the rights that it assured were flatly denied. We will show how captured English and American airmen were treated not as prisoners of war, but criminals, lynched in public. The fate of the Soviet prisoners of war in Germany is a tragedy of the greatest extent. Of 3,600,000 prisoners of war, only several hundred thousand are still able to work. But perhaps the deportation of slave labor was the most horrible and the most extensive slaving operation in history. You'll have difficulty, as I have, looking into the faces of these defendants and believing that human beings could inflict such suffering, as we will describe and prove here. We will not ask you to convict these men on the testimony of their foes. There is no count in the indictment that cannot be proved by books and records. The accused shared the Teutonic passion for thoroughness in putting everything on paper.
Right at the outset of the trial, the issue arose as to whether we should proceed primarily as a documentary case.
Whitney R. Harris, of the American Prosecution, author of Tyranny on Trial.
Or whether we should introduce witnesses supplementing their testimony with documents. Justice Jackson was persuaded that we should establish essentially a documentary case. He realized that if we could prove our case through captured German documents, the German people would never be able to deny the validity of the evidence.
May it please the tribunal, I refer to document 243 OPS, a motion picture entitled Nazi Concentration Camps, which the United States now offers into evidence. It was compiled from motion pictures taken by Allied military photographers as the armies in the West liberated areas in which these camps were located.
Thank you, Major Donovan. Please run the film.
Frank, the butcher of Poland, swallows hard, blinks hard, trying to stifle tears. Admiral Donitz has head bowed, no longer watching. Zaukel shudders at picture of Buchenwald crematorium oven. As human skin lampshade, as John Stryker says, I don't believe that. Goering coughing. Frink crying bitterly, claps hand over mouth as women's naked corpses are thrown into pit. Stryker shows signs of disturbance for the first time.
I sat in the visitor's gallery at that time and I watched the defendants. And to sit there and see at least Funk, Reichsbank president, minister of economics, I noticed was breaking down and crying and crying and crying. The man who said he didn't know anything about concentration camps in the cellar of his building, where the boxes and boxes and boxes with the hair and the gold teeth and the toys of the children that were killed in the concentration camp that had been transported into his building that he was in charge of, and he claimed he did not know. And here it was shown on the film. He broke down.
Rudolf Hess had flown to Scotland in 1941 and been imprisoned in Britain for the remainder of the war, had behaved in an increasingly erratic manner, which led to further questioning of his fitness to plead. This issue was brought to a head on November the 29th.
Dr. Rochard, I think you should be aware that the defendant is determined to attract your attention.
He has already passed me a note, my lord, asking to speak for himself on the issue.
From the beginning, we have been clear that the defendants can only address the court through counsel.
Yes.
One moment. The tribunal feels that on this particular issue, the defendant should speak for himself. Will the defendant Hess approach one of the microphones?
I should like to make the following declaration before the tribunal, although originally I intended to make it during a later stage of the trial.
Mr. President, henceforth my memory will again respond to the outside world. The reasons for stimulating loss of memory were of a tactical nature. Only my ability to concentrate is, in fact, somewhat reduced. But my capacity to follow the trial, to defend myself, to put questions to witnesses, to answer questions myself, is not affected thereby. I should point out that I also simulated loss of memory with my counsel. He has therefore represented it in good faith.
The court will adjourn until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Weekend, December 1st, 2nd. Hess very pleased with himself for having fooled everybody. When I reminded him of my comment about not coming into court again before the hearing, he said, yes, that's why I decided it was time to stop the game. However, when I gave him memory tests, his performance had improved only slightly. All of the foregoing gives a clue to his hysterical reaction to an idea that was catastrophic to his ego. Not to be in the limelight.
December the 13th, 1945.
Exhibit 254. A fist-sized nut-brown object. This is the shrunken head of a Pole, executed for having sexual relations with German women. Ilse Koch, wife of the Buchenwald commandant, had used it as a paperweight.
When I came to Nuremberg in August of 1945 and was assigned the task of preparing the case against the Gestapo and the SD and Ernst Kaltenbrunner, I learned that British intelligence had taken into custody a man by the name of Otto Ohlendorf, and that Ohlendorf was the head of OMP 3 of the Reich Main Security Office.
SS General Otto Ohlendorf, called as the prosecution witness, had been placed in charge of one of the murderous Einsatzgruppen, whose function was the annihilation of Jews, gypsies, and political commissars. He was examined by Colonel John Harland Amon, one of the toughest American prosecutors.
Do you know how many people were liquidated by Einsatzgruppe D under your direction?
In the year between June 1941 and June 1942, the Einsatzkommando reported 90,000 people liquidated.
Did that include women and children?
Yes.
And was this known to at least some of the defendants?
To General Keitel and to Kaltenbrunner after he took over the Gestapo, yes.
On what pretext, if any, were they rounded up?
On the pretext that they were to be resettled.
Will you continue?
After registration, the Jews were collected at one place, and from there they were later transported to the place of execution, which was, as a rule, an artificial ditch or a natural excavation. The executions were carried out in a military manner by firing squads under command. They were transported only in as many numbers as could be executed immediately to keep the span of time which the victims knew what was to happen to them to a minimum.
Was that your idea?
Yes.
Were all the victims executed in the same manner?
Until spring of 1942. Then an order came from Himmler that in future women and children were to be killed only in the gas vans. The shootings, he believed, were placing an intolerable strain on the Einsatz personnel. That was shortly after he'd witnessed an execution himself.
And how did these vans work?
They were like closed trucks, and when the engine started, gas, monoxide, was conducted into the van. The victims were driven to the place of burial, and the time for transportation was usually sufficient to ensure the death of the victims, about 10 to 15 minutes.
And how were these vans received by those operating them?
They did not willingly use them. The unloading of the corpses was an unnecessary mental strain.
What do you mean by that?
The position of the corpses, and probably because certain functions of the body had taken place, leaving them lying in filth.
Did you have no scruples regarding the execution of the orders you have described today?
Yes, of course.
And how was it they were carried out regardless of the scruples?
Because to me it is inconceivable that a subordinate leader should not carry out orders given by the leaders of the state.
Was the legality of the orders explained to these people under false pretenses?
I do not understand the question. Since the order was issued by the superior authorities, the question of legality could not arise in the mind of individuals, for they had sworn obedience to the people who had issued the orders.
Could any individual expect to evade the execution of these orders?
No. The result would have been a court-martial with a corresponding sentence.
I have no further questions.
Dr. Franz Blaha, a Czech doctor, an inmate of Dachau.
During my time at Dachau, I performed 12,000 postmortems, and I was a witness to thousands of medical experiments carried out on healthy human victims. Dr. Escher conducted experiments on the effect of cold water on humans, looking for a way for reviving airmen who had fallen into the ocean. The subject was placed in ice-cold water and kept there until unconscious, his blood being sampled every degree drop in rectal temperature. Some men stood it for as long as 36 hours, and their temperature dropped as low as 19 degrees centigrade. Then they were removed. There were attempts to revive them by artificial sunshine, or electrotherapy, or animal warmth. For this last, prostitutes were used, and the body of the unconscious man was placed between two women. The majority died, and of the survivors, many became mentally deranged.
Dr. Blaha, did you have visitors to Dachau while you were there?
While I was there, Himmler came, and so did Bormann, Gauleiter Wagner, and State Ministers Frick, Rosenberg, Frank, Sauckel, Kaltenbrunner, and others. It was arranged for them to meet a selection of inmates: a high-ranking Czech officer, then a homosexual, a gypsy, a Catholic bishop, a university professor. The visitors must find it entertaining.
Estimated deportations to concentration camps from Western Europe: Denmark, 5,200, Norway, 5,400, Luxembourg, 6,000, Holland, 12,000, Belgium, 37,000, France, 250,000, of which only 35,000 returned home.
Madame Vaillant, could you hear? You were an inmate of the Auschwitz concentration camp?
Yes. I, along with the rest of 260 women from Paris, was assigned to a sewing block at Auschwitz, and we lived right where the trains stopped. They ran practically up to the gas chambers. Consequently, we saw what happened there. We saw old couples forced to part from one another, mothers forced to abandon their young children. All these people were unaware of the fate awaiting them. To make their arrival seem more pleasant, an orchestra composed of internees, all young and pretty girls dressed in little white blouses and navy blue skirts, played during the selection process gay tunes from The Merry Widow, The Tales of Hoffman, and so forth. From our block, we could see, after about three quarters of an hour or so after the arrival of a convoy, large flames coming from the crematoria, and the sky was lighted up by the burning pits. All my life, I will remember Annette Poe. I saw her on a truck that was taking people to the gas chambers. She had her arms around another French woman. When the truck started, she called to me, "Think of my little boy if you ever get back to France." Then they began singing La Marseillaise.
During the break, Otto Kranzbühler, Dönitz's newly arrived counsel, unexpectedly appeared at the door of the attic lunchroom. He was ashen-faced.
When I heard the testimony of Vaillant Couturier, I was very shocked. I couldn't imagine that such a thing really happened, and I wondered and asked myself and all the others, what they knew about it. And the general answer was, we did not know. And that's what I want to maintain today. Most people didn't know a bit about it. Dönitz certainly didn't know a thing about it, because I had no business in the Polish concentration camps.
On February the 11th, 1946, the Soviet prosecutor Rodenko stunned the defendants by producing the former Field Marshal Friedrich Paulus, who had surrendered the German forces under his command at Stalingrad and then gone over to the Russians. Now he confirmed that he had been specifically assigned to develop a surprise attack on the Soviet Union.
Who of these defendants was an active participant in initiating the war of aggression against the Soviet Union?
As I observed them, they were the chief of OKW Keitel, the chief of the operations Yodel, and Göring as commander-in-chief of the Air Force.
The tribunal will recess.
Ask that dirty pig if he knows he's a traitor. Ask Powers if he's taken out Russian citizenship papers.
This tribunal will recess.
February 17th. Colonel Andrus asked me to draw up new seating arrangements for the defendants at lunch, all with a view to defeating Goering's attempts at terrifying the rest into supporting Hitler and the Nazi myth. I created a youth lunchroom, Speer, Fritzsche, von Schirach, Funk, and an elders' lunchroom with intractable Nazis like Raeder, Streicher, and Hess, who hopefully could neutralize each other. Goering was to be kept alone. Later, Speer told me that the new order had made him much freer to plan his own defense, to denounce the whole Nazi state, even Hitler himself.
Roman Rudenko, chief Russian prosecutor, was a 38-year-old Ukrainian of peasant stock.
We have estimated that 1,670 Orthodox churches, 337 Catholic churches, 69 chapels, 532 synagogues have been razed to the ground through the action of the invading forces. 1,710 cities and over 70,000 villages have been almost totally destroyed, as have 31,850 industrial establishments, 40,000 hospitals, and 25 million people are homeless.
The main refuge from the daily revelations of Nazi horror in the courthouse,
Herbert Hunter, communications expert,
was the Grand Hotel. That was Nuremberg's showpiece, Hollywood come to Bavaria. One was constantly reminded of the famous film pre-war under that name.
Chief Justice Jackson invited the stenographers and clerks to the social events because their wives were not allowed to come over at that particular time. There wasn't any housing for them. Bomb had been dropped right down through four floors, so the hotel was connected together with walkways from one section of the building to another.
I stayed about a week in a room there, and I had to walk over a catwalk across that hall to my room.
But down on the first floor was the marble room. It was a dining room. It was called an army mess then. And they were very pleasant and very friendly. They sang all these songs.
Anna Cameron, stenographer.
They used to sing this in the German accent to the tune of Lily Marlene. Dear Mr. Truman, why can't we go home? We have conquered Berlin and we have conquered Rome. We have defeated their master race. So why can't we get shipping space? Oh, please, Mr. Truman, why can't we go home and let the boys at home see Rome?
There, liquor was plentiful, and the amusement was continuous right through to the small hours of the morning. And the songsters, conjurers, jugglers, you name it, they got it. And there was also the very high rave music of the orchestra, which was called Koenig's Continentals. Now, Herr Koenig knew how to rave it up all right. It was said that at 7 o'clock in the morning a bell was rung, and that was a signal to return to one's own bed. And when you saw staid barristers jitterbugging, that was a new word in those days, jitterbugging with secretaries, and then watched couples vanishing, or dribbling is the word, up the stairs to the floor above, you knew why Nuremberg came to be called Carnival Round the Hangman's Rope.
The defense case began on Friday, the 8th of March, 1946. Professor Rainer Schroeder, German legal historian.
The three main lines of arguments for the defense were: what has been legal before 1945 cannot be illegal afterwards. We only obeyed orders by the Führer. And you cannot impose a retroactive law, and you cannot punish people according to a law which never existed before.
Nuremberg was the end of the Second World War.
Anatoly Yakushevsky, Russian military historian.
But it took place after the speech of Churchill in Fulton. That was the first volley of new war, Cold War, the beginning of new relationship in the world.
We knew that the Russians would ask for the death penalty for everybody.
It was natural for the Soviet Union that lost during the war 27 million people to demand capital punishment to all leaders of Reich.
the British attitude...
Lord Shawcross, Chief British Prosecutor and former Attorney General.
...remained to nearly the end in favour of summary execution rather than a state trial. The Americans, on the contrary, were very much of the opposite view. I also favoured the idea of a trial. They thought it could be a lengthy process, that it would involve a great deal of argumentation, and that points would be raised against the Allies that were embarrassing.
March 13th. When I went down to see Goering before he came up to court today, there were the signs of nervous tension in the slight tremors of his hands and the jerkiness of his facial expression. And he began to rehearse his role as martyred nobleman, about to take the stage for the last act. I still don't recognize the authority of the court. I can say, like Mary Stuart, that I can be tried only by a court of peers. He smiled a little, but I said, the issues at stake here go to the root of civilized existence. If 5 million Germans were killed, he replied, that is a matter for Germans to settle. Bringing heads of sovereign state before a foreign court is presumption unique in history.
Goering was a condottiere.
Peter Weberall, interpreter.
He was the type of person that might have lived as they did in the Renaissance without any principles of good or evil. He did not seem to know the difference. I don't think Goering had to do much lying in the witness box, because he explained why these things were necessary. He said once, every bullet that leaves the muzzle of a police pistol is my bullet. If that be murder, then I am a murderer.
Goering had an obviously strong personality and a sense of humor. My difficulty with him was not to catch his eye, because if anything went wrong in the course of the trial, and things did go wrong, somebody was expected to answer a question by saying yes, and answered it by saying no. And then if you caught Goering's eye, he would raise his eyebrow and shake his head sadly, and you had to resist the opportunity of laughing.
He had the cruelest mouth I ever saw, but his defence was absolutely brilliant, and I use the word deliberately because it wasn't so very long previously that he'd been weaned off drugs. Evil, yes. Big, yes. But I never forgot that cruel mouth.
I swear by God, the Almighty and Omniscient, that I will speak the pure truth and withhold or add nothing.
When Justice Jackson faced the problem of cross-examining Hermann Goering, he was very much concerned about this danger that the British had spoken of, and of which we were all aware. If Goering could get away with making speeches and arousing the German people, how would we stop the other defendants who were going to testify? Therefore, Justice Jackson decided that he would start the examination in a quiet way, that he would endeavor to prove through Hermann Goering the basic conspiracy, which was the major part of the American case.
Much of the credibility of the trial was seen to depend on the outcome of his cross-examination by the chief U.S. prosecutor, Robert Jackson. One of the British members of the tribunal, Sir Norman Birkett, had written, "It will be a duel to the death between the representative of all that is worthwhile in civilization and the last important surviving protagonist of all that was evil. In a sense, the whole result of the trial depends on that duel."
You're perhaps aware that you are the only living man who can expound to us the true purpose of the Nazi Party and the inner workings of its leadership?
I am perfectly aware of that.
Upon coming to power, did you not immediately abolish parliamentary government in Germany?
The parliamentary or democratic system which previously existed had brought Germany to the verge of ruin. I might remind you that your own President Roosevelt, as far as I can recall, I cannot quote it word for word, declared, "Certain people in Europe have forsaken democracy because democracy had brought forth men who were too weak to give their people work and bread and to satisfy them. For this reason, the peoples have abandoned both the system and the men belonging to it." There is much truth in that statement.
After you came to power, you regarded it necessary in order to maintain power to suppress all opposition parties?
Through opposition, we had been completely ruined. It was now time to have done with it, to start building up.
And you considered it necessary to establish concentration camps immediately in order to eliminate opposition. Is that correct?
Yes.
And to deprive persons of the right to public trial in independent courts?
There were two categories. Those who had committed some act of treason against the new state were naturally turned over to the courts. The others, however, of whom one might expect such acts but had not yet committed them, were taken into protective custody, and those people were taken into concentration camps. Later, once as Prime Minister...
Let us omit that. I have not asked for that. If you just answer my questions, we shall save a good deal of time.
But I would like to make an explanation.
Your counsel will see to that. Now, the concentration camps...
Mr. Jackson... The tribunal thinks the witness ought to be allowed to make what explanation he thinks right.
This tribunal thinks that, then I will listen to your answers.
Jackson was no match for Goering. Jackson tended to regard cross-examination as a matter of argument. And, of course, Goering was a far abler man than Jackson. And in any matter of argument, Goering inevitably came out on top.
Now, I want to review with you briefly what the prosecution understands to be the public stance taken by you in the Jewish question. From the start, you regarded the elimination of the Jews from economic life as one phase of the four-year plan under your jurisdiction, did you not?
Elimination as far as large industries were concerned, yes. This was because there were continual disturbances in large industries, some of them armament industries, still partly under Jewish directors and with Jewish shareholders, and that caused unrest.
And did you proclaim the Nuremberg Laws?
As president of the Reichstag, yes.
And that was the beginning of legal measures taken against the Jews?
That was a legal measure, yes.
And in December 1936, at a time when many Jews were leaving Germany, you promulgated an act making it a death penalty for Germans to transfer property abroad.
Without permission of the government, yes.
Then in November 1938, you imposed a fine of 1 billion marks for atonement on all Jews.
I have already explained how all these decrees were signed by me, and I assume responsibility for
them. Then in February 1939, you personally signed a decree, did you not, that Jews must surrender all objects of precious metals and jewels within 2 weeks?
I don't recall it. But no doubt it is correct.
And did you not also, in November 1940, sign a decree forbidding compensation to Jews for any damages caused by either enemy attacks or German forces?
If you have it there before you, then it must be correct.
Now, you testify that after the 1938 riots, which became known as Kristallnacht, in which 815 Jewish shops were looted, 20,000 Jews arrested, and 191 synagogues set on fire, you called a meeting on the 12th of November, which was attended by, among others, Heydrich of the SS, the Minister of the Interior, Frick, and of the Führer's assistants, Goebbels.
Hartmann Hilgart, representing the insurance companies, was also present.
And he pointed out that most of the goods in the stores were on consignment and not the property of the shopkeepers, and unpaid invoices were being sent in from firms, many of which were not Jewish. Now, I quote, Hilgard, we will have to pay for them too. Goering, I wish you had killed 200 Jews instead of destroying such valuables. Heydrich, there were 35 killed. Do I read that correctly?
Yes. This was said in a moment of bad temper and excitement.
Spontaneously sincere, was it not?
It was an expression of spontaneous excitement. And if you are going to bring up every word I said in the course of 25 years in these circles, I myself could give you instances of even stranger remarks.
It was one part of a number of such comments, was it not? Here, for instance, Dr. Greb brings up the subject of preventing Jews from going to German holiday resorts.
I have the document here, and I said it would be better to give them a part of the forest for themselves if you want them out of the rest.
Well, can you not read the whole of what you said? You continue. I quote, and Alpers will see to it that the animals damnably like the Jews, the elk too has a hooked nose, go into the Jewish enclosure and settle down among them.
Yes, I said that, but it must be linked to the atmosphere of the whole meeting.
Well, toward the close of that meeting, you said the following, did you not? I quote, I demand that German Jewry as a whole shall, as a punishment for the abominable crimes, etc., make a contribution of 1 billion marks. That will work. The pigs will think twice thereafter. I would not like to be a Jew in Germany. Were you joking about that too?
I have told you exactly what led to the fine of 1 billion.
By May 1944, Allied aircraft were becoming a serious problem, were they not?
That is correct.
And you held a conference at which it is admitted, quote, the Reich Marshal, yourself, wishes to propose to the Fuhrer that American and English crews who shoot indiscriminately over our towns at moving civilian trains or at soldiers hanging to parachutes should be shot immediately on the spot. Have I correctly read that?
It says so here. And I have thought a long time about how this could have got into the notes, which I never saw. And the only explanation that I can suggest is that at the time the Fuhrer did publish a directive in this respect, and that the minutes should not read, the Reich Marshal wants to propose, but I might have suggested that the Fuhrer had some such intention.
In all the 2 days' notes, this is the one that you say is mistaken.
I believe so.
I think that is all I wish to ask.
There were two stars. One is a dark star and one is a bright star. The dark star being Hermann Göring. Won a grudging admiration from people there for his absolute defiance of the court, his unwillingness to bend, and his rather clever defenses that the German nation had behaved no differently in acquiring territories than the British, their empire, or the Americans in subduing the West and wresting it from Indians, and it was no more tightly organized than the Catholic Church. Very clever mind. On the other side, the side of the angels, is Sir David Maxwell Fife, who was one of the brilliant prosecutors in Great Britain.
When Göring came to be cross-examined by Maxwell Fife, who was my junior in the prosecution, he was cross-examined by a man who was brought up in the police court and who knew exactly how to cross-examine. And the way to cross-examine is not to ask a question that you don't know the answer to.
Now the British prosecutor, Sir David Maxwell Fife, took over the cross-examination, directing himself immediately to Göring's knowledge of the shootings of escaping British airmen.
Give the witness General Grosch's statement. Now, if you will look about four paragraphs down, it begins a few days after the escape. Do you see that?
Yes, I have found it.
A few days after the escape, Oberst Walder informed me that the OKW had called a conference in Berlin and that the spokesman of the OKW had informed them that there was a decision that, in recapture, the escaped British airmen were not to be handed back to the Luftwaffe, but were to be shot. Oberst Walder informed me that the meeting was told that they would receive nothing in writing, and that the circle of those in the know was to be kept as small as possible. I asked Walder if anything had been said about the Reichsmarschall having been informed, and was told that he had. That same afternoon I rang up my superior officer and expressed to him my concern that A, the breach of the Geneva Convention, B, the possibility of reprisals against German prisoners of war. General Foster spoke immediately with Field Marshal Milch and returned to tell me that the Field Marshal had made necessary notes.
Mr. President, this is an affidavit, and I object to it being used, as the prosecution can easily...
Dr. Starmer, the defendant, Göring, is being cross-examined for his credibility. He said that he knew nothing of this matter, and he has been cross-examined as to credibility, and it has been proved that he has lied when he said that. Please continue. Do you still say, in view of these statements, witness, that you know nothing about the murder of British officers from Zagen?
Yes, and these statements exactly confirm this. There are no precise dates mentioned for the meeting, and there is no direct evidence that General Milch referred the matter to me.
So, you are leaving the responsibility for these murders on the shoulders of your junior officers?
No, I do not want to do that. I want to maintain that I was not present when the Fuhrer gave his command for the shootings. A further point is that those men captured by our own guards were returned to the camp and not handed over.
You know that according to General Wieland, a list of British officers considered to be disturbing elements was selected by the commandant of your camp. Are you telling the tribunal you did not know your own officers were selecting men to be shot? In any other service in the world, attempt to escape is regarded as a duty of an officer, is that not so?
That is correct, and I have emphasized that. But there was no selection made for shooting. Those who were recaptured by the police were shot, without exception. Those who were returned to the camp under my control were not shot. Only if the shootings had been carried out by my men might it have been possible for me to circumvent it. If the Fuhrer had told me
I will persist in this decree which I gave the police. I would not have been able to order the police not to carry it out.
Well, that may be your view, that you could not have got anywhere with the Führer, but I suggest to you that when all these officers on your service knew about it, you knew about it too, that you did nothing to prevent these shootings, but you cooperated in a foul series of murders. Let me now remind you of the affidavit of Hertel, of the RHSA. He says that approximately 4 million Jews have been killed in the concentration camps, while an additional 2 million met their deaths in other ways. Are you telling this tribunal, a minister with your power in the Reich, could remain ignorant that this was going on?
These things were kept secret from me. I might add, not even the Führer knew the extent of what was going on.
Let me read from Hitler's comments to Admiral Horthy, the Hungarian leader. The Jews have been treated as germs with which a healthy body has been infected. What else could that mean? This from a report made directly to you in 1942. There are only a few Jews left alive. Tens of thousands have been disposed of.
I knew only of a policy of emigration, not liquidation of the Jews.
No further questions.
March 24th. Hess said he has decided not to take the stand because he was concerned that his memory problems would not enable him to answer the questions the prosecution would ask. He insisted it was his own decision. But I know Goering and his attorney Zeidel have urged him not to take the stand.
Я приступаю к своей вступительной речи, завершающей первые выступления главных обвинителей на данном процессе.
To listen to a language in your ears and to speak a different one is a very demanding job. Nervous concentration here is enormously important. The difficulties for the interpreters were quite considerable. If the speaker happens to speak rapidly, too rapidly, the interpreter, even the best of them, can get hopelessly lost. Therefore, we had two lights in front of the Lord Justice Lawrence, a red one and a yellow one. The interpreter monitor who sat with the interpreters, if the speaker started to speak too rapidly, would press the button for the yellow light, which means please slow down. And if it got completely lost, he would press the red light, which means I must ask for a recess for a moment.
Without the simultaneous translation, the trial would have lasted 3 times as long as it did. And it is partly because of that system that the trial was completed in a little more than 11 months.
I have heard of only one case where a lady interpreter got into her interpreting slot and the session started and she had been staring at the defendants and she broke down. She broke out in tears, had to be moved out. Not because of anything somebody said, but the very fact that she saw these people that had done so much harm to her family. So many members of her family had been killed.
Joachim von Ribbentrop was the Nazi foreign minister. He was a swaggering, arrogant, former champagne salesman who had risen high in Nazi circles by bootlicking Hitler and dropping names. At Nuremberg, he is a whipped dog, tail between his legs, totally confused as to what went wrong with this great dream he was living, refuses to clean his cell. Colonel Andrus gets after him. The place stinks, and constantly shuffling around for the one paper that he can't find that's going to prove his innocence.
I personally never wanted war.
Then let me read you your own words on Danzig. We want war.
It is quite clear that is nothing but diplomatic talk.
Don't you think there's any requirement to tell the truth in a diplomatic conversation?
Witness,
your explanations are too long, too argumentative, and too repetitive.
Will you agree that this document, surrendering the remaining independent part of Czechoslovakia to Germany, was obtained from Czechoslovakia's president by the most intolerable threats of aggression?
No.
But what further pressure could you apply than to threaten to march in and also bomb Prague?
War.
War. What is that but war? Now, your counselor suggested that you were an honorary member of the SS. That is not actually the case.
That is exactly how it was. Hitler felt I should have a uniform for appropriate occasions, so I joined. A lowly rank at first.
Becoming an Obergruppenführer on the 20th of April 1940.
But without ever taking any steps or doing anything myself in the SS.
Don't you remember getting a special death's head ring and dagger from Himmler for your service then? Don't you? Isn't this your personally signed application? And isn't this a later request for a death's head ring? Size 17?
No, that is not so. If it says so on my application here, it is not correct. But I think that at one time I received a so-called dagger, like all SS.
And you continued to maintain an interest in the SS well into the war, didn't you?
That is possible, of course. We had a great deal to do with the SS in all fields.
You had. And especially in the field of concentration camps, hadn't you? Are you saying that you did not know that concentration camps were being carried on an enormous scale?
No, I knew nothing about that.
May I request that the map behind the witness box be unfurled?
Marshal?
Would you look at the map behind you for a moment? That is an enlargement of the exhibits put in by the French prosecution, and the red dots are concentration camps. Now we can look at the location of your six private residences. There. The one in Berlin. Sonnenberg.
Sonnenberg is an hour's drive from Berlin.
North of Berlin.
East.
All right. Now let's take another house. Your Schloss at Fuchsel, near the border. And just over the border, and very near it, the group of camps which existed near Mauthausen. You see that group there on the map?
I should like to state on my oath that I heard the name of Mauthausen for the first time in Nuremberg.
Let us take another of the places, one you say you did go to very often, that you used to...
I believe I can make this more brief for you. I can say that I heard of only two concentration camps until I came here. No, it was three. Dachau, Oranienburg, and Theresienstadt. Theresienstadt was an old people's home for Jews, visited by the Red Cross a few times. But I had never heard previously of all the other camps. I wish to make that quite clear.
Do you know that near Mauthausen there are 33 camps within a comparatively short distance of one another, and 45 camps as to which the commandant did not give names, because there were so many of them. And in those 33 camps there were over 100,000 internees. Are you telling the tribunal that in all your journeys to Fuchsel you never heard of the camps where 100,000 people were shut up?
That was entirely unknown to me, and I can produce dozens of witnesses who can testify to that. Dozens.
So you are telling this tribunal that anyone could be a responsible minister in a country where hundreds of concentration camps existed and not know anything about them? Except three.
It may be amazing, but it is 100% true.
How could you be ignorant of these camps? Did you never see Himmler?
No, I never saw him about these things. Never. And I am positively convinced that the other gentlemen in the dock also knew nothing about what was going on.
And Auschwitz?
That was entirely unknown to me.
Well. Now, every time today when you've been confronted by a document which attributes to you some harsh language or the opposite of what you have said here, you say that on that occasion you were telling a diplomatic lie. Is that what it comes to? Thank you very much.
Does the Russian prosecutor wish to cross-examine Lieutenant Colonel Rudenko?
Do you consider the seizure of Czechoslovakia an act of aggression?
No.
Poland?
No.
Denmark?
No.
Norway?
No.
Greece?
No.
The Soviet Union?
No.
I'm sorry to see Ribbentrop breaking down, Goering said, but he was hopeless as a foreign minister. He never had the background for international diplomacy. Hitler had never traveled abroad, and just because some of Ribbentrop's customers when he was a wine salesman happened to include some English noblemen, Hitler thought he had a man with connections. Ribbentrop's wife came to the court and left a message for her husband, a reminder to complete his will.
The most disgusting of the defendants were not the most dramatic ones.
William Stricker, head of the American-controlled German news agency.
Streicher, of course, Seyss-Inquart, Kaltenbrunner, Funk. All these people who also were relatively well-educated, allegedly civilized people who had committed the most incredible crimes and did not admit it, and they tried to convince the court that they didn't know what was going on.
When you're casting a movie, you want a Nazi to look a certain way. Ernst Kaltenbrunner filled the bill magnificently. He was about 6'4", a man who was described as having a head as wide as his shoulders, hulking, lumbering, ungainly. He had a long purple scar across his cheek, the kind of Nazi that people love to hate.
Kaltenbrunner, the chief of the Reich Main Security Office, was a lawyer, a very intelligent man. Kaltenbrunner's defense was that Himmler told him that Mueller, the head of the Gestapo, would continue to handle all matters relating to concentration camps, and that Kaltenbrunner should spend his time on intelligence matters. That was his defense.
Did you have anything personally to do with any of the atrocities which occurred in concentration camps during the war?
No.
And therefore you assume no responsibility before this tribunal for any such atrocities?
No.
Very good. And you had nothing personally to do with the program for the extermination of the Jews except to oppose them?
No, except I was against it. From the moment I knew of his actions and had convinced myself of it, I raised objections with Hitler and Himmler, and the final result was they were stopped.
And does the same apply to the program of forced labor?
Yes.
And the same applies to the execution of 50 British flyers in connection with Stalag Luft 3?
Yes.
Very good. Is it not a fact that the Gestapo AMT-4 of the Reich's Central Security Office prepared reports on concentration camps which were submitted to you for signature and then passed on to Himmler?
No, I do not recall any such reports. The normal channel was that Mueller reported to Himmler directly.
Well, let me ask you whether in the company of other SS functionaries you made an inspection of Mauthausen.
To my recollections, I went there alone to report to Himmler, who was touring the south.
And you went only into the quarry, right?
Yes.
You were acquainted with Karwinski, the Austrian State Secretary in Adolf's cabinet.
I met him once, only once. He visited a detention camp when I was leading a hunger strike in 1934.
Then can I read this affidavit from him? It's document number 3843 PS. Quote, I saw Kaltenbrunner again in the Mauthausen camp when I was severely ill and lying on rotten straw with several hundred other seriously ill people, many of them dying. Kaltenbrunner walked through the barracks with a brilliant suite of high SS functionaries and must have seen everything. We were under the illusion that these inhuman conditions would now be changed, but they apparently met with Kaltenbrunner's approval, for nothing happened. Unquote. Is that true or false, Lieutenant?
I can refute this document, evidently presented in order to surprise me in every point.
Well, perhaps you will wait until I have read you a further exhibit. Do you remember ever having witnessed a demonstration of three different kinds of execution at Mauthausen at the same time?
No, that is not true.
Now, this affidavit comes from a Johanna Kandut, an inmate who worked the heating for the cremation of the bodies. Now, if you will turn to the second page. Question. What did you see during Kaltenbrunner's visit? Answer. Kaltenbrunner, along with others, went laughing into the gas chamber. Then the people were brought from the bunker to be executed, and the executions by hanging, shooting in the back of the neck, and gassing were demonstrated. After the dust had disappeared, we had to take away the bodies. Is that true or false?
Under my oath, I wish to state solely that not a single word of these statements is true.
Right. Now, who was responsible for the order to kill all inmates of Mauthausen shortly before the end of the war?
Such an order is unknown to me.
I wish to have the defendant shown document number 3870 PS, the dying confession of Seyreis, the camp commandant at Mauthausen. I wish to liquidate all prisoners on the instruction of SS Obergruppenführer Dr. Kaltenbrunner. The prisoners were to be led into the tunnels of the Bergkristall. The ends were to be blocked off by explosions. I refused to carry out the order. You still say you had nothing to do with the order?
Most emphatically. The prosecution know perfectly well, and it must have been proved to them in dozens of testimonies, that I had never had any authority over Mauthausen. And what authority does the statement taken from Colonel Seyreis by a camp inmate while he was dying of severe gunshot wounds have? Very little. I ask, sir, not to take me unawares and maneuver me into a position where I might go to pieces. I shall not break down. I swear to you, and I have sworn that I want to help you to establish the truth.
Is it not a fact
that you have lied to this tribunal about almost everything you have given testimony about?
Mr. President, for a whole year I have had to submit to this insult of being called a liar. And for a whole year I've been interrogated hundreds of times, both here and in London, and I have been insulted in this way, and even much worse. My mother, who died in 1943, was called a whore. And many other similar things were hurled at me. This term is not new to me, but I should like to state that in a matter of this kind, I certainly would not tell an untruth.
The lawyer representing Kaltenbrunner had considerable difficulty in finding witnesses who might shift responsibility away from his client. He came up with one, Rudolf Franz Hirsch, the commandant of Auschwitz. Under cross-examination by Armin, it did not take him long to implicate Kaltenbrunner.
Witness, this is your affidavit, is it not?
Yes.
So will you follow along with me as I read, please, starting with paragraph 2. I commanded Auschwitz until the 1st of December 1943 and estimated that at least 2,500,000 victims were executed and exterminated there by gassing and burning, and at least another 500,000 succumbed to starvation and disease, making a total dead of about 3 million. This figure represents about 70 to 80% of all persons sent to Auschwitz as prisoners. That is all true, witness?
Yes, it is.
Starting with the middle of paragraph 3.
Yes.
While Kaltenbrunner was chief of RSHA, orders for protective custody, punishments, and individual executions were signed by Kaltenbrunner or by Müller as Kaltenbrunner's deputy. Again, is this statement true?
Yes, it is.
And now on to paragraph 7. Children of tender years were invariably exterminated since, by reason of their youth, they were unable to work. Very frequently, women would hide their children under their clothes, but of course, when we found them, we would send the children in to be exterminated. We were required to carry out these exterminations in secrecy, but of course, the foul and nauseating stench from the continuous burning of bodies permeated the whole area. And all of the people living in the surrounding communities knew that exterminations were going on at Auschwitz. Is that all true and correct, witness?
Yes.
How many men did it take to kill 2,000 persons a day?
I had a staff of approximately 3,000 men. I must also make clear I did not tolerate gratuitous cruelty. My men were there to exterminate people, not to torment them.
At lunch there was a depressed silence. All Goering would say, along with Dönitz, was that Hirsch was not a Prussian. A Prussian could never bring himself to do things like that. But we heard no more of his sarcastic scoffing that killing so many people was a technical impossibility.
There's a disturbingly sad figure in the dock at Nuremberg. His name is Hans Frank. Frank was a lawyer. He also happened to be picked very early as Hitler's lawyer, which led to a very swift rise for him. And as a reward for his services to the party, he is made the Governor General of occupied Poland.
What my father has done hit me very early. I think it really started together with the trial in Nuremberg, because the first time we saw pictures, pictures of concentration camps, pictures of corpses laying around, especially corpses of children. So I knew from the very beginning Poland also was connected with my father, with Hans Frank, and also with me, because I lived during those years where little children were smashed against the walls by Germans and by German soldiers. And this really got a very big impact on my soul.
The tragedy is that this is a man who sold himself to the devil, and essentially a sensitive man who would while away his hours in the cell by playing in his head Wagner and other German composers.
My father was very ambitious, but what my father liked most was having a good car, especially a Mercedes, having good houses, especially castles. He admired Hitler very much. He said the Jews must be eliminated. When we catch one, it is his end. But he never was anti-Semitic. If Hitler would have said, let's kill all the Czechs, or all the Danes. He would immediately talk about the Danes and the Czechs like he used to talk about the Jews. So he doesn't care about other human people if Hitler asks for it. And so I think that's the reason why Hitler sent him to Poland, the first country where the Germans could butcher all the people they don't like.
Did you ever participate in the annihilation of the Jews?
I myself have never installed an extermination camp for Jews or promoted the existence of such camps. But if Adolf Hitler personally has laid the dreadful responsibility on his people, then it is mine too. For we have fought against Jewry for years and we have indulged in the most horrible utterances. My own diary bears witness against me. Therefore, it is no more than my duty to answer your question in this connection with... Yes. 1,000 years will pass, and still this guilt of Germany will not have been erased.
But during this period, you fought against Himmler.
Yes.
And spoke out against the SS state.
If justice is not supported, the state loses its moral foundation. It sinks into the abyss of darkness and horror. The police state must never exist, never.
Dr. Seidel, can you clarify a point? Are there any passages in these documents supporting the defendant Frank's attitude towards the SS, which express the opinion that the same principles ought to be applied to others than fellow Germans?
No, sir, there are not.
Thank you.
At one point in the trial, a lumbering giant is called as a witness. He's something like 6 feet 6 tall. The Nazi defendant, Frick, had called Hans Bernd Gisevius as a witness because he had once been Gisevius' boss. He had been himself with the Gestapo in its early stages, saw what an abomination it was, and had resigned, thereafter became a spy for the Allies, unknown to the Germans till the end of the war. So he is given this splendid opportunity to suddenly testify, and allegedly in their defense, and lays them all low, revealing the very worst that he knew about them.
It was Göring, the iron Göring who protected Himmler and his move to introduce protective custody in concentration camps. Even in those days, there were literally thousands of cases of people who had offended the Gestapo in some way and were arrested. Then, a little later, they were reported as having committed suicide or contracted a sudden illness and died.
In other words, these men formed a ring around Hitler, controlling what he heard and who had access to them.
Yes.
And that group included Göring, Ribbentrop, Keitel, Kaltenbrunner, Frick, Schacht, and Dönitz, Raeder, Sauckel, and Speer.
Not Schacht. He never controlled access to Hitler. But you should have included Jodl.
That is all.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson.
I want to thank you, Mr. Prosecutor, for giving me the opportunity to testify emphatically on behalf of the dead and the living.
During the afternoon recess, Jodl, purple with fury at the result of Gisevius' evidence over the Rome blood purge. It's a disgrace for decent people who followed in good faith into a filthy pigsty, he shouted. He was on the point of tears, could not control himself. They were a bunch of dirty swine on both sides. Schacht and Speer could hardly conceal their satisfaction at the revelations. At the end of the session, Göring tried to harangue the other defendants into resisting going back to jail. He virtually had to be pushed into the elevator. Schirach commented, Gisevius may have done little good for Frick, but he's doing Göring a lot of harm.
The case against Julius Streicher was much sharper in focus than most people think, I believe.
He had founded a rag, an anti-Semitic rag, called Der Stürmer, which had lurid stories in it of Jews raping and seducing pure Aryan maidens and pseudo-scientific dispositions on the contaminating influence of Jewish sperm, absolute garbage and rubbish, which was very popular newspaper throughout a good part of the Nazi era.
During the war, he talked about the noticeable departure of the Jews and how great this was for the world and for the German nation.
Streicher was cross-examined by the junior British consul, Griffiths Jones.
And in your speech of April 1933, you said, quote, "For 14 years we have been crying to the German nation, German people, learn to recognize your true enemy." Is that true?
Yes.
And in doing so, is it true that you had been preaching religious hatred?
No,
The Jews are a race, not a religious group.
But in your speech you call them a nation of bloodsuckers and extortioners.
That is not preaching religious hatred. It's just a statement of facts.
I want to make myself quite clear to you in what I'm suggesting. That from 1939 onwards you set out to incite the German people to murder and to accept the fact of murder of the Jewish race. Do you understand that?
That is not true.
And let me quote from another of your articles published in Der Stürmer on May the 6th, 1943. Der Stürmer sent its photographer to various ghettos in the East. Nothing can surprise him easily, but what he saw in these ghettos was a unique experience for him. He wrote, "What my eyes and what my Leica saw convinced me that the Jews are not human beings, but children of the devil and the spawn of crime. This satanic race really has no right to exist." I have no further questions.
He is so unacceptable, even by the Nazis, that he's kicked out of office, though he continues printing Der Stürmer, and actually sat out the war in a farm that he owned.
The choice of defendants was not very well thought out.
Bernard Meltzer of the American prosecution.
Public opinion, particularly in the United States, required an indictment of industrialists and bankers who had put the German war machine together. Schacht was a banker with all sorts of international connections. The lefty press is saying Schacht will be acquitted. I knew that Mr. Justice Jackson was very anxious that Schacht not be acquitted. Schacht's contention was he had wanted Germany rearmed because, one, Germany was in a sea of armed nations, and two, he wanted to negotiate from a position of power. But his argument was he had no knowledge of aggressive war. He had been dismissed from the Reichsbank in 39, was in a concentration camp after the bomb plot against Hitler had failed. He was arrogant, he was cocksure, felt aggrieved. He was convinced that he was going to be acquitted. Funk succeeded Schacht as head of the Reichsbank. As Minister of Economics, Funk engaged in preparation for the aggression against Poland, of which he was aware, and economic preparation with reference to the attack on Russia.
The best lawyer there, Captain Kranzbühler, who was the lawyer of Dönitz, at that time was still youngish. He had made career in the Nazi Reich, and from what I know, and I had a few talks with him, I believe he had been a convinced Nazi.
Admiral Dönitz was a first-class military commander, and as a personality, most impressive, but not easy to handle. At the beginning, I had misgivings about him. Most of all, I didn't like his political speeches. But when I knew him at Nuremberg, I more and more accepted him as an extraordinary officer. And after trial, we became real friends.
In 1942, a British merchant ship, the Laconia, carrying 1,500 prisoners of war, as well as some 900 others, including the crew and civilian men, women and children, had been sunk by a U-boat off the west coast of Africa. Dönitz, contravening his own former instructions not to rescue survivors, permitted the U-boat commander, Werner Hartenstein, to stay and mount a rescue operation, and also to send an SOS, in English, guaranteeing the safety of any ship responding.
Now, in the opinion of the prosecution, Admiral, you also used that incident to carry out in practice an idea you had cherished for a long time, namely, in the future, to kill the shipwrecked. What is your view on this?
Actually, I cannot say anything in the face of such an accusation. The whole question concerned rescue or non-rescue. It was a fact that we rescued with devotion and were bombed while doing so. I think, therefore, that no more words need be lost on a rebuttal of this charge.
In the second paragraph of the so-called Laconia Order, it says, "Rescue is contrary to the most primitive laws of warfare for the destruction of enemy ships and crews." What does that sentence mean?
Well, the prosecution says that I could quite simply have ordered that safety did not permit a rescue. But in the Laconia case, I did that several times. But given the true situation, it was not enough, so I now had to make a clear order which excluded all discretion and where the commander was, in these cases, no longer the master of his own desires.
Now, you heard the witness Corvette and Captain Merler state in this court that he misunderstood the order in the sense that survivors should be killed, and in several cases he, as commander of U-boat warfare, instructed commanders in that sense. And you, as commanding officer, do have to assume responsibility for a misunderstanding of your order.
Of course, but Merler is the only person who had doubts of this kind. I only wish he had sought clarification, but I am convinced that no other U-boat captain shared them.
Throughout the trial, the defense had not been allowed to invoke the tu quoque argument, which is that you cannot justify your wrongdoing by proving that your enemy did the same. Kranzbühler succeeded in turning this on its head, suggesting that what the Allies did was right, and if Dönitz did the same, he was right too.
In order to follow my opinion, I asked for the testimony of Admiral Nimitz, commander of the Far Eastern American Navy. There was a fight for that in camera, but Judge Biddle supported me, and on that basis I got the testimony of Admiral Nimitz showing that American warfare in the Pacific was exactly the same or even much more extending than the German warfare in the European theater.
The case against the military, with which I was very particularly concerned, was difficult in one particular way, because there is a tendency of people, at any rate in our sort of societies, to assume that soldiers, and particularly generals, are all honorable people. And we were going against the grain when we alleged, for instance, that they were cooperating with the SS in the most atrocious behavior.
Alfred Jodl is, in some degree, still a controversial casualty of the Nuremberg trial. He was the general that you often see in newsreels and documentaries at the right-hand side of Hitler as they're looking over the maps. A small and undistinguished-looking man, bald, with a pinched expression on his face as though he'd been weaned on a lemon. He is the man who hands out to the troops, to the forces, the orders for executing hostages in occupied countries for acts against the German occupying forces. So he's a conduit for cruelty.
I am Louis Jodl. I'm half English, the wife of General Colonel Jodl. We married only in March 45. My husband never was a party man, and he never had contact with the whole crew of the party. He was an absolutely non-talking man, and he was so despaired, absolutely despaired. When he came late, he came at about 2 o'clock from Hitler. You know, those last months were no fun at Berlin. 3 times bombing in the night. First Americans, then the British, and in the last days the Russians too. And I was dead tired and he was dead tired, and we sat there and talked with our little dog and drank something, and we were both absolutely exhausted. And I was absolutely dismayed when I learned that he was to be judged as a war criminal. And then I hitchhiked to Nuremberg. It was raining, and Nuremberg was a heap of stones. And then I came to the prison. I am the wife of General Colonel Jodl. May I speak to my husband? And of course they were a bit astonished, and he said, you may write to him. And then he came back with the first letter, and then everything was easy.
Colonel General Jodl was cross-examined by the British prosecutor, Khaki Roberts, who held the head of the Wehrmacht in particular disregard for his involvement in war crimes.
The day came where he himself was to give evidence, and of course we were very excited. I absolutely trusted that he would be honest and that he would not hide anything. He was an intelligent man.
Now, this so-called Barbarossa order, which you took part in drafting, let me read from paragraph 6. Do you have it?
Yes.
In view of the vast areas in the east with no established security, forces available will be sufficient only if all resistance is punished, not by legal prosecution of the guilty, but by occupation forces spreading such terror as is alone appropriate to eradicate every inclination to resist. That is a terrible order, is it not?
No, it's not at all terrible. It is established by international law that the inhabitants of an occupied territory must follow the orders and instructions of the occupying power, and any resistance against the army occupying the country is forbidden. It is, in fact, partisan warfare, and international law does not lay down means of combating partisans. The principle of such warfare is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and that is not even a German principle.
Not the tooth and the eye of the innocent.
It is a question of those who resist. That is, by partisan warfare.
I will not argue about it, witness. I gather you approve of the order.
I approve it as a justified measure conforming to international law.
And as to handling those allied military personnel sent to work sometimes with partisan groups behind the lines, Hitler ordered that they be shot forthwith and neither tried nor imprisoned.
Yes.
And you have said that this part of the Führer's order disgusted you.
Yes.
One of the things which went against your inner convictions, to use your words.
It was one of the four orders I received from the Führer, which in my mind I completely rejected.
But these young men went on being shot, did they not?
In reality, only a very few incidents occurred, and I believe that most were highly justified, because their fighting methods were not those of honest soldiers.
You talk of your inner convictions. But would we have heard anything of these convictions if Germany had not lost the war?
No. But if the British had lost, we might then have heard about the German soldiers they had strangled during the Dieppe raid in 1942.
I will leave that. I want to ask now about the shooting of the 50 British airmen who had escaped from Stalag Luft 3. You said that after this incident you thought Hitler was no longer humane. Did you say that?
I had the impression he was disavowing all humane concepts of right.
Had you thought he was humane in March 1944?
Before this time, all his previous orders could still be justified in some way. They were reprisals, but this act was not a reprisal.
Would you agree with me that this was sheer murder of these 50 airmen?
Yes, I agree with you completely. I consider it sheer murder.
How then could you, honorable generals, go on serving a murderer with unabated loyalty?
I did not serve with unabated loyalty after this event, but I did everything in my power to avoid further injustice.
I want to put to you my last document. Did you make a speech to your staff shortly after an attempt on Hitler's life in July 1944?
Yes, even while my head was still bandaged, I was sticking close to the Führer.
Did you begin by saying the 20th of July was the blackest day which German history has yet seen?
That is possible.
Why was it such a black day for Germany? Because somebody tried to assassinate a man whom you now admit was a murderer?
Should I, at a moment when I too am about to be blown up in a cowardly, insidious manner by one of my own comrades, together with many of the Führer's opponents, should I perhaps approve of it all? If a man with a pistol in his hand had shot the Führer and then given himself up, it would have been entirely different.
Do you think it was more dastardly than shooting 50 American soldiers who landed in the north of Italy to destroy a military target, shooting them like dogs?
No, that was also murder, undoubtedly, but it is not the task of a soldier to be the judge of his commander-in-chief. May history or the Almighty do that.
Do you still say that you are an honorable soldier, a truthful man?
Mr. Roberts did not make it easy for him, attacked him not in a very gentleman way. Yes, of course, he had signed, but always on the order by Hitler, never himself. Hitler knew what he had in him, and he knew also that man would not betray him.
July 1st, 1946. Hearing on the Katyn massacre, in which the Russians alleged that in 1941 the German army had murdered up to 11,000 Polish officers in Katyn Wood near Smolensk.
The Germans told us that when the Germans came into the area of the Katyn Woods, they already found thousands of corpses there that probably were the Poles killed by the Russians. We didn't believe them, quite honestly.
Stalin's regime committed great crimes against humanity. Katyn massacre is one of them.
The feelings about Katyn were certainly ones of great reservations by the Americans, the British, and the French. At that time, the Soviets had borne the burden of the war. There was quite a tendency to want to have some favoritism to them, and even though it was a dictatorship, to have a going concern with them.
The prosecution, especially the British and the American prosecution, in my opinion, they are all very honorable men. But as a team, I couldn't accept it because there were too many dirty tricks in this whole trial. I couldn't accept that there was a general indictment signed by Jackson and Sir David McElfife and so on, charging the Germans with Katyn, while they knew the Russians had done it. That was rather scandalous.
The judgment of the tribunal doesn't mention it at all. And I presume that's because, as a matter of political common sense, the justices didn't want to have one small issue in terms of the total affecting the relationships between the judges, etc.
One of the most intriguing internal dramas at Nuremberg was the prosecution of Albert Speer, the slave driver of Nazi Germany who ran the German armaments industry with the aid of hundreds of thousands of conscripted forced workers, and the slave trader, Fritz Sauckel, who was a working class lout who went throughout Europe rounding up these people, coercing them into working into the German armaments ministry.
Infuriated by Sauckel's prevarications and over-lengthy replies, the American judge Francis Biddle decided to cross-examine Sauckel himself.
Now, the 5 million workers brought into Germany, how many were voluntary and how many were involuntary? You stated in March 1944 that less than 200,000 came voluntarily.
That was unquestionably a clerical error, an utterly impossible proportion.
White. Now, in France, you did have an enforcement force of your own, didn't you, of 1,000 SS? Why did you employ this force? I thought you kept away from police measures.
In order to have protection for these people and for those places, which were frequently raided by the resistance.
I see what you mean. This was an organization to protect recruiting that was going on, is that right?
Yes.
Well, then what it boils down to is it was either the police or the military or some other force which indirectly were carrying out your objectives. Is that right? Is that right? Note that the defendant has nodded.
Clearly, one would think that the guilt of the slave master is greater, since thousands upon thousands of these workers died under the most wretched conditions, virtually starved to death, worked to death there under Speer. Certainly, his guilt would have to be equal, if not greater, than Fritz Sauckel, who was merely rounding up these workers. He was a very cultivated man, a very handsome man, a man of the German upper classes, the kind of German who would be having dinner at the club of one of the judges if he was not on trial at Nuremberg.
Speer was first questioned by his lawyer on his relationship with Sauckel.
Earlier, the defendant Sauckel claimed he worked for you. Is this true?
Of course. I expected Sauckel to meet above all the demands of war production. But I did not control Sauckel.
Mr. President, the prosecution has raised accusations against the defendant as a member of the so-called joint conspiracy. We now wish to address the defendant's activity in tempering Hitler's destructive intentions in Germany towards the end of the conflict. Herr Speer, during these last phases, were you able to carry out measures that were in open defiance of Hitler's resistance to the last?
In those last days, I was able to issue orders under the name of General Weinler, which ensured the preservation of important railway lines and of signal and postal installations. What I was not able to stop, for they were outside my jurisdiction, were the destruction of bridges and attacks on the basis of life, agriculture. The sacrifices which were made on both sides after January 1945 were senseless. The dead of this period will be the accusers of the man responsible for that fight, Adolf Hitler. The same is true of the ruined cities, which in this last phase were terribly damaged. Many of the difficulties Germany is suffering today are due to the ruthless destruction of bridges, traffic installations, trucks, locomotives, and ships. The German people remained loyal to Adolf Hitler until the end. He betrayed them with intent. He tried to throw them finally and permanently into the abyss. Only after May the 1st, 1945, did Dönitz try to act with reason. But by then it was too late. I have no further questions.
This session is adjourned.
He was an engineer, an architect, a very technically minded man, an analyst of a situation, and he analyzed his situation brilliantly at Nuremberg. He knew that defiance was not going to work, that denial was not going to work, and so he very cleverly threw himself upon the mercy of the court by taking the position that the judges wanted to hear.
To those of us guarding the defendants, Göring was Fatso. Jodl, the happy hooligan, after the sad-faced comic strip character. Funk, on account of his weak bladder, was known as the pisser. Ribbentrop was the Mad Hatter. Speer, however, was always Mr. or Herr Speer.
The Reich Minister for Armaments was cross-examined by Robert Jackson. Surprisingly, Jackson did not question him in any depth, either on the part slave labor had played in keeping the German war machine rolling, or on his knowledge of concentration camps.
Let me ask you about some of your methods in improving production. Krupp was a very large user of both foreign labor and prisoners of war?
No doubt.
Now, I'm not here attempting to say that you were personally responsible for these conditions. I merely want to describe the conditions for which the regime was responsible. You're familiar with Dr. Jaeger's affidavit?
Yes, but I consider it somewhat exaggerated.
You don't accept it?
No.
Well, you say that you have no direct knowledge of conditions in the camp, so how do you know that it's exaggerated?
If such conditions had existed, I would probably have heard of them. They could have affected output. It can only have been a temporary phase, following an air attack.
Well, let me call your attention to a new document, 398 from Hofer, now living and working in Essen. Thank you. Quote, Lohenkamp was brutal to the foreigners. He confiscated food and took it home. He had a steel cabinet built so small one could hardly stand, and he locked up foreigners in the box, women too, for 48 hours at a time, without food or being allowed to relieve nature. He fired on the Russians. He delivered Russian girls without bothering about the children afterwards. Now, is that report exaggerated too?
I consider this affidavit a lie. I would say that among German people such things do not exist. And if such individual cases occurred, they were punished. It is not possible to drag the German people in the dirt in such a way.
What about the sealed boxes?
I don't believe it. After the collapse in 1945, a lot of affidavits have been drawn up, which do not fully correspond with the truth.
Well, let us look at Exhibit D382. It's a photograph of one of these steel boxes described earlier and used at several sites. Is this merely an exaggeration?
This picture is of a normal locker. These photographs have no value as evidence.
Then look at Exhibit D230. These are steel whips. And we have evidence of 80 being distributed.
Those are nothing but replacements for rubber truncheons. We had no rubber, and for that reason the guards probably had something like this. It doesn't mean they used them any more than your police use their rubber truncheons.
You said you planned to assassinate Hitler. Why did you then take enormous risks to fly to Berlin to see the Führer in his bunker?
I felt it was my duty not to run away like a coward, but to stand up to him. Again.
Yesterday you stated you had a certain responsibility as a government minister. What are those responsibilities?
One is the responsibility for his own sector, and he is fully responsible for that. Above that, there is a common responsibility amongst leaders for fundamental matters.
So what you're saying is that you acknowledge responsibility for large policies, but not for all the details in their execution. Is that a fair statement of your position?
Yes, indeed.
That concludes the cross-examination.
At the end of the court session, there were evidences of a profound reaction both for and against Speer. Schock declared with feeling that was a masterful defense. That was the position decent Germans were in. Göring tried to be moderate in giving his reaction to Speer's denunciations. What a tragicomedy. Don't you think it's funny? I was hated and ordered shot by the Führer at the end. If there is to be any denunciation of the Führer, I was the one who had the first right to do so, not these others like Speer and von Schirach, who were favored by the Führer to the very end. All right, I know what you are going to say. It is true. But I mean, he could have at least said it differently. Then I said, don't you think that all these medieval concepts of loyalty and nationalism are out of date, and that people will think differently in the future? Well, then let those who belong to the future think differently. I am what I have always been, the last Renaissance figure, if you please. You can't expect me to change at the age of 52 my entire concept all of a sudden.
Sir Hartley Shawcross, delivered his summing-up speech in late July 1946.
Several times a week, buses with opaque windows would arrive at the nursing home in the little town of Yadamar. They carried those who were insane, feeble-minded, epileptic, old. And that arrival was observed by the townsfolk, as was the smoke which rose from the crematorium chimney. The pastor of the town has described how there was endless rumour and speculation, particularly as no one was allowed into the home. Even the schoolchildren knew these vehicles and used to say, "There comes the murder box again," or an argument, "You're crazy, you'll be sent to the baking ovens in Yadamar." If children knew what was happening, then how can these defendants have remained so in ignorance? What peculiar dispensation of providence was there that protected them from knowledge of these matters? Matters which were their concern. 12 million men, women and children have died thus, murdered in cold blood. And millions upon millions more today mourn their fathers, their mothers, their husbands, wives, children. What right has any man to mercy who has played a part, however indirectly, in such a crime? Göring's responsibility in all these matters is scarcely to be denied. Behind his furious bonhomie, he was as great an architect as any in this satanic system. Men do not advance into foreign territory, pull the trigger, build the gas chamber, collect the victims, unless organized and ordered to do it. The Führer principle was the creation of the Nazi Party and of men like Göring. Ribbentrop's part also is clear. No one in history has so debauched diplomacy. No one has been guilty of meaner treachery. But he, like the rest, is just a common murderer. And Keitel and Jodl, were they less involved in murder than their confederates? They cannot deny knowledge or responsibility for the murderous Einsatzkommandos, with whom their own commanders worked closely and cordially. And the defendant Frank has stated himself that, and I quote, "One cannot kill all lice and Jews in one year." No coincidence that his was exactly Hitler's language. Some of these men are more guilty than others. But what matters if some forfeited their lives only a thousand times over, while others deserved a million deaths? Let this account of the German businessman Graeber, who witnessed just one mass murder, stand for all the thousands in which these men are implicated. Without screaming or weeping, these people undressed, stood around in family groups, kissed each other, said farewells. During the 15 minutes that I stood near, I heard no complaint or plea for mercy. I watched a family of about 8 persons, a man and a woman, both about 50, with some children of about 1, 8, and 10, and 2 grown-up daughters of about 20 and 24. An old woman with snow-white hair was holding the 1-year-old child in her arms and singing to it and tickling it. The child was cooing with delight. The couple was looking on with tears in their eyes. The father was holding the hand of a boy about 10 years old and speaking to him softly. The boy was fighting his tears. The father pointed to the sky, stroked his head, and seemed to explain something to him. At that moment, the SS man at the pit shouted something to his comrade. The latter counted off about 20 persons and instructed them to go behind the earth mound. Among them was the family which I have mentioned. I will remember a girl, slim with black hair, who, as she passed me, pointed to herself and said, 23. I walked around the mound and found myself confronted by a tremendous grave. People were closely wedged together and lying on top of each other so that only their heads were visible. Nearly all had blood running over their shoulders from their heads. Some of the people shot were lifting their arms and turning their heads to show that they were still alive. I estimated that the pit already contained about 1,000 people. I looked for the man who did the shooting. He was an SS man who sat at the edge, his feet dangling into the pit. He had a Tommy gun on his knees and was smoking a cigarette. In one way, the fate of these defendants means little. Their personal power lies forever broken.
But this trial must form a milestone in the history of civilization, not only bringing the severest retribution to these guilty men, not only marking that right in the end shall triumph over evil, but also that the ordinary individual must not transcend the state. Mankind comes to this court and cries, "These are our laws. Let them prevail." And when you come to your decision, remember the story of Graeber, but not in vengeance, but in a determination that these things shall not occur again. The father, do you remember, pointed to the sky and seemed to say something to his boy.
The tribunal will adjourn.
Following a month's deliberation, the verdicts were handed down on October the 1st, 1946.
Defendant Hermann Wilhelm Göring, on the counts of the indictment on which you have been convicted, the International Military Tribunal sentences you to death by hanging.
Göring came down first and strode into a cell, his face pale and frozen, his eyes popping. "Death," he said as he dropped on the cot and reached for a book. His eyes were moist, and he was panting, fighting back an emotional breakdown.
Defendant Rudolf Hess, imprisonment for life.
Hess strutted in, laughing nervously, and said he had not even been listening, so he didn't know what the sentence was.
Defendant Joachim von Ribbentrop, death by hanging. Defendant Wilhelm Keitel, death by hanging. Defendant Ernst Kanzel Gruner, death by hanging. Defendant Alfred Rosenberg, death by hanging. Defendant Hans Frank, death by hanging.
But in Nuremberg, he admitted his guilt. And I always thought that would be the turning point in his life. But if you hear his voice admitting his guilt, he acted like he was still a big party guy talking to millions of people. There was no emotion in his voice. And seeing that he didn't get the right result, he said in the very end of his trial, "I also have to alter the admission of guilt because all the crimes, the Allied forces, and especially the Polish, Czech, and Russian people committed against the German people has already taken away all the guilt of Germany." He became Catholic because, as I found out, he thought, "When I become a Catholic, maybe the Pope will help me to survive." And he also counted on the mercy of the judges when he admitted guilt. I'm happy that it didn't work.
Defendant Wilhelm Frick, death by hanging. Defendant Julius Streicher, death by hanging.
The death penalty against Streicher was the most difficult to be justified because he hadn't done a real crime. He had made propaganda, but nobody could tell that he was really guilty of anything.
One can make a case that being vulgar and crude and anti-Semitic is not a capital offense. I would say that a man like Streicher got far fairer consideration than some poor child who was forced into a gas chamber at Auschwitz as the end product of the kind of rubbish that he was preaching.
Defendant Walter Funk, imprisonment for life. Defendant Karl Dönitz, 10 years imprisonment.
Dönitz didn't quite know how to take his sentence. 10 years, he said. Well, anyway, I cleared the U-boat force.
Dönitz was given 10 years, in my opinion, because he was the successor of Hitler. And the tribunal didn't want to let him free. Completely silly. He certainly was not convicted of anything regarding warfare. As I told reporters after the conviction, 10 years for me was the minimum sentence for the innocent.
Defendant Erich Schroeder, imprisonment for life. Defendant Balder von Schirach, 20 years imprisonment. Defendant Alfred Jodl, death by hanging.
My husband and myself were absolutely stunned by the verdict and chiefly by the way of death. With a bit of luck, he could have come through perhaps with 20 years of prison. So I think that this whole attitude of being treated as a criminal, not as a soldier, was largely due to the fact that he did not take more distance from Hitler. I once wrote to him, but he wrote, "I will never do anything unfair."
After he had been unhandcuffed, Jodl faced me. "Death by hanging. That, at least, I do not deserve." His mouth quivered and his voice choked for the first time. "That I did not deserve."
Defendant Arthur Zeiss Inquart, death by hanging. Defendant Fritz Sauckel, death by hanging.
Sauckel was perspiring and trembling all over when I entered his cell. "I have been sentenced to death," he spluttered. "I don't consider the sentence fair. I always wanted the best for the workers. I have never been cruel myself."
Defendant Albert Speer, 20 years imprisonment.
"For me, it was not justice to hand a death sentence to Sauckel and give 20 years to Speer. My opinion is that Speer had contacted the American prosecution behind the scene to have some bargain. Otherwise, it can't be explained."
"I'm very glad he wasn't sentenced to death, because afterwards he was very cooperative, not only in connection with the investigations of the prosecution, but also the books he wrote later on, particularly Inside the Third Reich, was really a tremendous contribution to history. And so I'm glad that he escaped the hangman's noose."
Defendant Konstantin von Neurath, 15 years imprisonment. Defendant Fritz von Papen, acquitted. Defendant Hans Fischer, acquitted. Defendant Hjalmar Schacht, acquitted.
The acquitted defendants, of course, were jubilant. They were going to have a press conference. And when Schacht came up, his name, by the way, is Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht. He was born in Brooklyn, New York. Anyway, he was asked a few questions, and he stopped at the moment. He says, "Please wait a minute, gentlemen." He said, in perfect American English, "When I leave here, I have nowhere to go except my daughter's. I have never visited her house without taking a gift to the children, and I have nothing. Now," he says, "if you were to contribute a pack of cigarettes or a bar of chocolate, I would have something for my grandchildren." And in a moment, there was a pile of PX goodies on the microphone in front of him. And I thought to myself, that old blankety blank, he's barely out of jail and he's in business already.
In absentia, defendant Martin Bormann, death by hanging.
After 315 days, the work of the tribunal was over. Those sentenced to death were to be hanged on or after October the 15th, but it was not known exactly when.
As it turned out, I was, of course, there that night at the Palace of Justice when the electrifying word came out that Hermann Göring had taken poison moments before the prison officer was marching to his cell to give him formal notice of his execution.
I was allowed to see my husband before the execution for, I believe, 20 minutes, but 20 minutes are very short to take leave forever. And I'm still fighting and will do so to my last day for the rehabilitation of my husband. I believe that hanging was not the way he should have been treated. In this last letter, Alfred wrote, "Love never stops."
7 years later, in 1953, a Munich denazification court was to posthumously exonerate Jodl, stating that he was not a major offender.
The first of the defendants to appear was the former foreign minister, Joachim von Ribbentrop. He stepped into the chamber. His manacles were removed. His hands were bound with a leather thong. He walked to the top of the stairs, and there he saw the hangman with the noose of the 13 coils and the hangman's assistant with the black hood. Asked to state any last words, he said, "God protect Germany. God have mercy on my soul. My last wish is that there be unity for Germany, peace between the East and the West, and for the world." They sprung the trap, and Ribbentrop died. In the same way, the other defendants were brought in and met the fate of common criminals.
The executions appear to have been bungled rather badly. The German field marshal, Keitel, was dangling for something like 23 minutes before he was pronounced dead by the doctors. There were other similarly long periods. In one case, we know that as the officials conducting the execution became impatient, we see Sergeant Woods, the army hangman, disappear underneath the gallows, which was closed off with a black curtain. And as best we know, he was tugging on the legs of one of these defendants to finish off the job that he had not done properly. He claimed afterward that he did not have the correct information on the weights of these people so that they wouldn't drop far enough and break their necks, which is supposed to be the humane thing that happens in hanging.
After the executions, the bodies were placed upon a simple wooden coffin, the noose still around their necks, they were photographed. The body of Hermann Göring was brought out and placed upon its coffin.
Three of the defendants who were serving term sentences were brought in to clean up the gymnasium where the executions had taken place. They were Albert Speer, Rudolf Hess, and von Schirach, the head of the Hitler Youth. Suddenly, Hess stands stock still and sees bloodstains on the floor, clicks his heel, and raises his arm in a Nazi salute.
This was the final act, in a way, of World War II.
It succeeded in asserting the accountability of individuals as well as states for criminal acts. It reinforced and clarified the law about what you can do even in war, the things that even in war you can't do, and about the legality of going to war, not going to war in certain circumstances. It has also produced a whole lot of authentic German documents which could not afterwards be denied, and therefore, historically speaking, it prevented the growth of legends as after the First World War.
We were laying bare, really, an attack on civilization, what Jackson called the supreme evil. Progressive war and barbarity is monumental and unique.
The flaws are fairly obvious. It was a trial by the victors against the defeated. And this can't be good, and it isn't right, jurisprudentially speaking.
Most of the German people did not care for this trial because they had nothing to eat. It was very cold. They had different problems. And they said, well, it's very good if these people are being put into court, then we won't have any trouble.
I think Nuremberg had to happen, but not in this way. The extermination of the Jews was such a tremendous crime that it should have been tried and people responsible and convicted. But it should not have been coupled and thereby minimized by political accusation like aggressive war.
We contended, of course, that an aggressive war was always a crime, that it was never legal for a country to fight a war except in self-defense. That had never been established so clearly as it was at Nuremberg. I have advocated ever since the end of the war that there should be an independent chamber of the existing international court sitting in continuous session to be called upon if needed and to deal with criminal offenses under international law.
I believe that Nuremberg, it isn't being studied today simply as a matter of political developments, but also in terms of studying the psychology of people who are oppressed, as I think the Germans were after World War I. I think the Treaty of Versailles was a great shame, and the way it was carried out was a great shame.
The Nuremberg trial itself did not have very much influence on the Constitution of 49, but the Nazi history had a big influence. The right of resistance to any illegal action of the state has been written down in the German Constitution. The Constitution, on another part, says lawyers, judges, public servants have to obey the written laws and the unwritten law.
Nuremberg certainly proved that there was no broad guilt of the German people as such. This general talk about the Germans, the French, or the British is a very bad generalization, because we ought to be talking more about specific people.
Those of us who had been with it from the beginning were beyond crying about it. Justice? There is no possibility of bringing people back to life. Real justice doesn't exist in that case. But truth is important, to have it all come out and show the proof that it really happened.
That night, there were two trucks that took the 11 caskets down to Munich to a crematory. The bodies were burned during the next day, And in the evening, the ashes were taken out and dumped into the river Isar. The dust of the dead then flowed along that stream into the Danube, and from the Danube into the sea.
Remember, Lord, not only the men and women of goodwill, but also those of ill will. But do not only remember all the suffering they have inflicted on us. Remember the fruits we bought thanks to this suffering. Our comradeship, our loyalty, our humility, the courage, the generosity, the greatness of heart which has grown out of this. And when they come to judgment, let all the fruits that we have borne be their forgiveness. Anonymous prayer found after the liberation of Ravensbrück.
In Nuremberg Trials, you heard Bernard Hepton as Geoffrey Lawrence, Henry Goodman as Robert Jackson, David Timson as Hartley Shawcross, Geoffrey Whitehead as David Maxwell Fife, Mike Nussbaum as Dr. Gilbert, Gerard Murphy as Hermann Göring, David Collings as Ribbentrop, and Ian Hogg as Kaltenbrunner. The trial sequences were selected by Peter Goodchild. Nuremberg Trials was produced and directed by Martin Jenkins and John Theocaris.